Thanks to our sponsor, Ecotricity. Ecotricity is New Zealand's only carbon zero certified electricity retailer. They offset all emissions sourced from wind, hydro and solar. Find out more at ecotricity.co.nz. Hello and welcome to How to Save the World episode,
we don't know.
It's 20-something, I think. Go us.
Yeah,
an episode a week for the last 20-something weeks.
Do you have quite an untidy desktop? Oh, sorry, I was distracted by the fact you just don't even know what episode this is.
Well, it's because we do. Hey, here's a peek behind the curtain. We preload a little bit, so we get drunk and record. We pre-record a few, and then we can sometimes muck with the order a little.
Or is it if I'm not very good, I'll just drop out, and you don't want to ruin the synchronization of your episodes.
You've got it. That beautiful voice that you hear, that familiar, iconic Kiwi larrikin.
Nasal whine.
Is Tereda, who is a broadcaster extraordinaire. You might have heard him over the many years on RNZ. You might have seen him on the telly, on his TV shows. A man who...
Might have seen him winning awards.
Exactly. More than any other New Zealand comedian, I think, has a very strong set of green bona fides. He's walked the walk and talked the talk for many years now. So we thought we'd have a sit down and chat with him. So, Radar, thanks for joining us,
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Welcome to the... this studio is really good most of the year, but we're just entering the sunny summer period now, and it gets real hot.
I was actually thinking that it was remarkably cool in here. Are we just before the sun heads over the yard arm and starts to blast you with its solar rays?
Wait for minute 17 of this episode, and all the CO2 will have built up in the room. We'll all be falling asleep and sweating profusely.
Well, it's good. I mean, I'm wearing black today because I'm just trying to get used to living in a hotter climate. You know, we've got to prepare. My wife said the other day, she said global warming, climate change will just be increasingly what people consider to be nicer summers.
That's a hell of a reframe.
We can all go home then.
Well, we did follow that on from a conversation around the fact that it's where we live. It's like living in a kind of a, like living in an alien world. And we're quite fair people. My daughter's very fair. She's only kind of four. And we look outside the door and we slather up and we put on suits of protection from the sun before we head outside. And then you do go outside into the sun. You go, this is horrible. It is a little bit like living in an inhospitable and somewhat alien world.
And we haven't ever really...
That's really my attitude. We just rolled with it. That's not even climate change. That's just an ordinary New Zealand summer.
Hey, in the interest of having a little bit of structure to this, what I'm sure is going to be a very loose and lovely chat, we were very interested to know about... You've been making TV shows and talking about sustainability and environmentalism for quite a long time. A lot more longer than it's sort of been in the very popular mainstream zeitgeist, which has happened recently. What was the genesis for you? Where does this come from?
It was coincidental, and it didn't start off so much. It was nothing that I did deliberately, and that I was unemployed, as I had been for a long time, making docos. And the reason we got into the first series Off the Radar was that Marcus Lush had been funded to make this program where he lived in a field. And Jam TV, who make intrepid journeys and various things, I'd known them, worked with them for years, took me out to lunch and said, hey, look, we've got this money and Marcus can't do this show. And so we went to TVNZ and I think they showed them part of my intrepid journey where I was stung in the groinal region by a scorpion and not only didn't die. It was great TV. It was terrifying. It was on camera and I literally thought I was going to die in the desert. But they said, look, you know, he seems to be enjoying it and he hasn't died. And they said, well, if he does die, no one cares. I think it was episode series 12 or something of Intrepid Journey. So there was
took a while to get to you.
Oh yeah, I'm not popular. And so they said, what are you doing? Do you want to go and live in a field for a year or so? And I went, yeah, sure. So I came to it sort of from a farming and a food point of view. At the time I was really interested in pork, like pig farming, because there was all this call around changing the way that we farmed pigs.
Was there around the time when Mike King flipped?
No, way before that. And it was to do with, there was a whole lot of stuff happening. Like, I quite like pork and chicken and these things, but I hated the way that it's farmed. And I was looking at the kind of cost structures of a protein, of a meat that was the cheapest in the market. It was being flooded by imports, still is, of which they have to meet no ethical standards, imported pork. They only have to meet a health standard. And so we were saying to our industry, you need to spend all this money and change this, that, and the other thing, sow crates and whatnot. And I was looking at this thinking, this could actually you could see this industry disappear here. Interestingly, I've been
doing
something
because of the competition.
Yeah, because of the competition from overseas, and you know this. And of course, it's not going to be an elf swine flu. You know, what is it? Half the world's pork population.
I thought we solved that one.
No, it's eradicated. Oh yeah,
swine flu.
Yeah,
oh, it never left.
China has killed in the last 12 months something like 100 million pigs. They've killed more pigs. They've slaughtered more pigs to try to stop the spread of it than all of the pigs in the American hog industry. And
holy
it's spreading globally.
Smokes.
And they're looking at a 25% death of pigs globally.
And actually, there is something in New Zealand too, because we live rurally and we received something from Ministry of Ag saying, do you have pigs? And
yeah,
they wanted to know. They just wanted it on
really
the register
bad.
Because
it's really
some...
Bad. Yeah. So that and that affects everything. That you know, if you look at that causal chain all the way down to someone who's growing soy or corn, and they want to feed the pigs, and that rising middle class in China, anyway, the point of that. So that journey came from there.
We gave Radar a coffee before we got on the recording.
It wouldn't have
everyone.
Made any difference. don't get me started on the effects of climate change on coffee. Oh no. But then that came all the way through, and I was just doing a presentation the other day on the future of farming, in its all of its many forms, and looking at Chinese pig apartments, which are a multi-story, you know, 12 or 15 story concrete blocks that they house 10,000 pigs in, using algorithms, AI, machine learning, microphones. They can hear a pig cough. Or the interesting thing for that was they could hear when a sow lay on a piglet, they could hear that sound. The machine would alert, you know, the computer would alert them, hey, go and sector level 5, sector 7, and roll that pig off. And thought, you know, imagine bringing that technology here to eliminate sow crates. This is a very long say. All I'm saying is that, you know, 15 years ago, I was concerned around where our food came from and the ethics of big ag and farming and sustainability. And then here we are, you know, now it's a mainstream conversation.
Mm.
It seems like you have a affinity for the future and for the science and technology of where farming's going. And you've got kind of a back catalogue of documenting your adventures into looking into food chains and food supplies and stuff. Like, what are you seeing out there that we wouldn't know about?
There's a lot of really amazing tech. And the future of farming is, you know, if you listen to Dr. Rosie Bosworth, fantastic. She's very much in that kind of tech world of plant-based proteins, fermented meat, all of this. But at a conference the other day, she said, you know, within 5-10 years, pastoral agriculture will be gone. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are saying that tech meat is going to replace animals. There'll be no more animal farming and this, that, you know, various other things.
And when you say tech meat, you're talking about
in a
cell-based
so grown in a fermented in a huge vat or created by tech people. And my question around that is, it's what do the banks say about that? Because what you're saying when you're going to say this, the pastoral agriculture will disappear, is you're saying the hundreds of millions, the billions of dollars of agricultural debt that the country languishes under, are the banks just going to let that disappear? Are they going to have farmers walking off the land? So I'm curious on that aspect of it, like where is it going scientifically?
Mm.
I'm also a little bit of a skeptic around food created in a lab.
You don't think we've maybe got the social and economic infrastructure to support a move
I think the social and economic infrastructure. I'm curious around the nutritional uptake. You know, we've all taken things apart that used to work and then put them back together and they didn't really work. And that's essentially what they're doing with food. There was a great article the other day of a guy who went to one of the big food fairs in America, you know, those huge things, thousands of exhibitors, and he was going along to the various counters and saying this, and trying to source the ingredients that you put into make this kind of food. You know, you extract a protein from a pea and whatnot. And he was saying to the people, how do you do that? What do you use? What chemical process, what chemicals are you using to extract all of this stuff and then to put it back into something? So I'm curious. I mean, I'm fascinated with it. And I'm not against it in any way, but I'm curious as to how that will progress. But I'm also mindful then of what happens, say, to New Zealand and an economy that really is, as soon as you get out of the city, you know, painters, decorators, plumbers, electricians, schools, whatnot, you know, all of that income that comes indirectly through farming.
Because I guess the broad story of what we've seen in the 21st century so far is tech people getting a lot of money and sucking it all up into a funnel and it reaching one,
you know,
tiny point. And you think that's where
You've got food sovereignty issues, you've got transparency issues, the whole thing. I don't know where farming is going to end up. It's going to be radically different. You know, and I think the days of... I've always been a critic of milk powder. You know, milk powder is...
Why are you a critic of milk powder?
Because it's just a low basic. It's nothing.
Lowbrow.
Not lowbrow. It's just it's the most basic thing. If you ever look at, say, Tatua Dairy Company, you know, high payout, you cannot become a supplier to Tatua. You're just impossible. They're full up, and it's, you know, years ago they made one of those decisions where they put in these milk powder dryers, and then the board went, you know what, we've made a mistake. And we're going to tell our shareholders, our farmer shareholders,
so you're sort of saying,
that they went, we're going to pull them out.
Like the markup. There's not a lot of margin on it.
It's a commodity at the whim of, you know.
And are we right now, is New Zealand quite hedged on being involved in that?
Yeah, we sell a lot of milk powder.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's this very vulnerable, low margin.
Low margin, it can be, product. You know, worst heart to it. They make nutraceuticals and all kinds of things. And you have your look, so Pāmu, formerly Land Corp, they're milking deer currently. They're investigating milking deer. Which is, if you've never seen that, Google on YouTube, I think there might be some clips of deer milking, the cutest thing you'll ever see. So there, and I think it's $80 a kilo for dried deer milk powder, but that's going into like high-end cosmetics, really high-end restaurants.
So obviously that's got a whole other different makeup than dairy cow milk.
Oh, totally different. Totally different. Huh. Richer, fatter, you know, it's not, you know, it's not the same thing. I'm not sure how we got here. But having said that, look, what I'm saying is, I'm curious around where the technology is going. I'm really curious and concerned about what happens to the entire swathes of global countryside with people who farm. But I'm also looking at some of the tech stuff that's coming through farming. So, you know.
Because I feel like you're a reasonably qualified person to ask about this, because you've had a career sort of interwoven with the agricultural and dairy industries
in my gumboots.
Yeah.
I grew up on a farm.
You grew up on a farm.
Whereabouts?
You do shows about farms.
North Waikato, dairy farm. We broke in what my dad at the time called swamp and what we now call wetland. and probably it will go back to wetland, I suspect, a lot of it. My brother's still farming. He's looking to get out of it because he's not into it. And dad did the thing that people were told to do in the kind of 90s, you know, go and increase the size of your herds. And he did it and looked at it and went, this is unsustainable. This is bonkers. Cut the numbers back very early.
How did that work for him?
Palm kernel and various things. Oh,
sorry.
Worked back. You know, the cows were less stressed.
But economically, how did that work?
Fine, because you're not having to bring in, you know, all of this other stuff. You don't have all the kind of animal health issues. You know, still a lot of cows.
This is what Mike Joy was talking to us about. Mm. He was saying, these Kiwi farmers don't seem to get if you reduce your herds, you can increase your yield.
You can. You probably, I'm not going to say I'm an expert on the things, but if, you know, it's like anything. If you're working really, really hard, every part of your system is stressed.
Yeah.
You know, your workers are stressed, your animals are stressed, your equipment is stressed, your land is stressed, and you take it back and go, what is the kind of optimum level of income that we require to service the debt for the land? And as I was saying, you know, the government, and it was both Labor and National government, said, go and farm us out of this situation.
Yeah, and here's a ton of fertilizer to do it. Here's really cheap
water.
Nitrogen stuff.
Here's water.
Right.
You know. And interestingly, I've just done a whole series of dinners around the future of farming with a fertilizer company, talking to farmers and various other people. And I like to do things like that, because where else do you get the chance to be a provocateur right in amongst the provinces from Northland down to Invercargill, and to sit with people and to say, well, what about this and what about that? And interestingly, one of the great comments came from an old farmer in Rangiora, who said he remembered his agronomy lecturer 20 years ago at Lincoln or whatever was saying, dairy will be the economic driver that greens the fields of Canterbury, and then dairy will move off for a more sustainable, ethical, economically valuable crop.
Hemp.
Could be hemp. It could be sheep. It could be meat. It could be sheep meat. It could be wool. It could be
croppings.
You know, carrots. New Zealand grows, I think, 95% of the world's carrot seed.
What?
What?
Yeah,
the seed.
Truly. The seed. Hmm. Yeah, we are the kings of carrot seed.
Who knew?
We should
get a campaign for that.
Yeah, man. You know, so you know, you may see a lot of that dairy move off. The problem being at the moment is you've spent, you know, millions of dollars on a bloody dairy shed. You're not going to just
so much of this comes
it.
Down to the economics of it.
It's
for
economics.
People. I think people's hearts and minds in so many cases are already there. They're just trying to work out the practicality of it.
But what you're also seeing is a shift away from solo farm mitigation to landscape, watershed, catchment scale. And so you've got some of these fertilizer companies now with a lot of tech around leaching and land use management and drones and GPS. So mitigation of, say, nitrogen and various other runoff from farms, instead of looking at it on a farm-by-farm basis, there's a lot of places now looking at a watershed or a catchment scale where do we invest our money in a project that will benefit much more than, say, some isolated riparian planting or a catchment pit on an individual farm. And so now that you're looking at things in a landscape, so they'll say, actually, if we built this big wetland here or restored a wetland, all of this catchment benefits. You know, it might be on one person's farm, but, you know, that conversation around putting money into this mitigation is a really fascinating one. So, you know, you restore a larger piece of land and it actually, you get it back to doing the function it's supposed to do.
With these conversations you're having with the farmers at the moment, Fonterra just had like a record loss reported this year. What's the mood of the people who have been up until this point a huge economic engine for the country?
There is a lot of despondency because, you know, you've had a bad review, Tim. I've had a bad review. I don't know if you've ever been reviewed.
I don't think I've been reviewed. What a happy place to be.
You seem excellent. You know, it gets to you. And so there's a lot of that. But having said that, there's also a lot of people doing some incredibly good work. And what was fascinating is there's a sort of a sense that those old farmers are just stuck in their ways. Actually, some of the most vibrant and adoptive and adaptive farmers are those older farmers who have seen all these storms, have weathered them. They know what's coming. They can see the changes. Maybe they're in a financially better position to make a lot of these changes to continue farming for the future.
Those old dogs as well are the ones who are going, okay, we've had 300-year storms in the last 3 years. This is not normal. Yeah. And they've got that experience of their whole life to be able to compare it.
You do get better at picking patterns as you get older.
And they know that all that change is coming. And there are other issues as well. You know, the fact that China has just bought Westland Milk, and what does that do with the sovereignty of that land? You know, we're already out there. There's the really big thing at Field Days this year. I do Field Days every year. I do the emceeing and welcome dignitaries to this showcase of agriculture, where most people go home with bloody stone cookware. So much stone cookware. The really interesting conversation, just about everyone said there are trees. They're sick of trees. All these trees.
How do you mean sick of them?
They're
sick of them.
Well, there's a, you know, we talk about, land being sold, you know. And so all this land is being sold to overseas pension funds, there's university endowments and various others to plant trees to offset, you know, carbon credits, which I always think is a little bit. I think carbon, you know, carbon credits are a little bit like saying, I'm punching you in the face, but I sponsor a child.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get them. But anyway, so you've already seen, there are communities who've seen their skills haven't been renewed. There's suddenly a loss of income. All these people who say all the shearing gangs used to shear up big valleys and all those valleys have gone. You've got people now saying, well, okay, what happens to pest control? There's a levy on meat that goes to some pest control, but suddenly this big property next door, great big station's going into trees. So there's no levy. So what happens to the pests in there and the
all coming out of these forests,
or the possums and various other things.
Right.
So it's an incredibly complicated kind of business. As much as you think, yeah, we've got to plant trees, you know, and I think trees are great, but you know, for manuka honey and pine, because pine grows fast. I basically just sort of call it kindling. You know, if we're looking at drier, hotter days and more extreme fire days, and we're planting a whole lot of manuka and pine. You know, I hope we're getting better at firefighting.
Away from the experts in this realm and the farmers and you giving these dinners to the insurance companies and these sorts of things, just in terms of you tripping around the country, talking to Joe Punter, are you finding a difference now versus 5 years ago in terms of the kind of conversations and awareness people are having about these issues?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, you do get caught up in a bubble when you go to places. You tend to often catch up with the same people that you know or you've met, and you see their journeys and where they're going. I think people are more aware of things, little things, coffee cups, and, you know, small things that really, they're kind of important, but on the bigger scheme of things, you know, and it's hard for people.
You don't think there's been a ground swell, a shift?
I think there has definitely around issues like water and rivers and all of that. And you know, you need those little gateways into
plastic,
larger conversations.
Another one.
Plastic bags, you know. But even if all of New Zealand gave up plastic bags, it's going to be great.
I'm finding
for us,
that the...
But it's not going to change the weather.
No. I'm finding that the conversations I'm having now are less around trying to say, hey, this is real, guys, this is happening. People, you don't need to start there anymore.
It depends on who you're talking to. But no, you're right. And it was actually for a long time, particularly around those kind of bigger climate change conversations, I just stopped listening to people and I stopped reading about it. And I got because I was suffering a little bit of eco anxiety. And a lot of me was just going, I didn't want to believe for a while. You know, Tim, we spoke to Alana Mitchell a while back and I was listening to her and I was going, you know what? Deep down, I just don't want you to be right.
Alana Mitchell, for those listening, is a marine biologist.
Oh, she's a journalist.
She's a science communicator, science writer, and journalist, and wrote this book called Seasick 10 years ago, which I think I might have mentioned on the podcast earlier. And it paints a pretty dire picture. And then also, I read that whole book cover to cover without knowing when it came out. I thought it came out like last year.
Yeah.
And then when I saw sort of copyright 2009, I was like, oh no.
Yeah, man, we've been talking about this for a long time. So yeah, it was interesting, and so now, when I was in my phase of just not paying attention to it deliberately, it was just making me feel upset, you know. I got asked by a conference for insurance brokers to give them a talk on climate change, and I said I don't really want to do that. And my agent said, well, they want to pay you this much, and I said I can probably do it. So I tried to find other things to talk about, because we sort of get fixated on some of the big things like sea level rise. I mean, that's a big thing.
Actually, it was the first thing I thought of when you said insurance.
Yeah, but it's more than that, because so I looked at all these other things. I looked at the fact that suddenly if you get a warmer and wetter climate, so say Auckland north and a little bit of the east coast, it's wetter, it's damper, suddenly you get all these mosquitoes that can't currently living here. And I just read a review and article about a book on the history of humans and their relationship with mosquitoes. You know, mosquitoes, according to the book, have killed more humans than anything else, including wars. Mosquitoes are just, and we think we're on top of this kind of thing, but suddenly you get dengue, Japanese encephalitis, Ross River virus, Nile River virus, suddenly you get that kind of thing here. And for anyone who hasn't travelled to places like that and hasn't undergone that kind of worry of dusk and dawn and slathered themselves and whatever's in that stuff that you put on and taken your bloody larium and hallucinated if you're an Air Force pilot and bombed the wrong place. It's a long story. Did happen, actually. Larium's a bad preventative for malaria. But suddenly that changes everything. Other little things, you know, and I said to them, when it gets a little bit hotter, what happens to people? They get a bit tetchy.
Yeah.
So your road rage, your urban incidents, your domestic violence, there was a correlation, I think, for every 1 degree that it got hotter, there was a 6% correlation in the increase of sort of incidents of civil violence. All of these things add up to
quite a different scenario.
A breakdown in civility. And we're already seeing that. And so,
bearing in mind that these insurance companies, and I know that you're not talking to the CEOs necessarily, but they're the people who are sitting on the biggest piles of cash and sort of determining where these funds travel and where the capital travels around the world. Do you get the sense that they're starting to get the message that they need to jump on board, because the trajectory they're on is going to screw them as well?
Companies, they employ some of the best brains in the world to enable them to continue making money. They are the best gamblers. You know, so they know there's all of that change. But, you know, does that trickle down to a brokerage level? So these people were brokers. Mm. And I showed them a photo. I took it off Trade Me the night before of sections for sale on the Whitianga waterways. And I said, does anyone who buys one of these sections ever come to you in advance to go, what's my insurance going to be like for one of these? And Belinda Story, who does work for the Great Southern Challenge, I think it is, which is the big government initiative around climate change and various other things, she looks at it through the insurance lens. And it's fascinating because she has some really interesting stuff. And what I like is her thing that says we need to look at property and our relationship with property and move from a freehold mentality to a leasehold mentality. And the leaseholder is nature. So we might get, I might buy a seaside property, and people are going, oh, but the sea level is going to rise. I go, yes, it will, but it's not predicted to rise for 40 years. Now, I'm happy to have this property in my family for 30 years, take a loss on it. Maybe someone will buy it for the next 10, and maybe someone else will go, oh, well, look, I might get another 3 years out of it. But as he's saying, it's not that communities are threatened, say, by their own properties being inundated, but you're threatened by suddenly having a council that can't get insurance on the roads that head along the coast. And so suddenly your access is cut because the insurance, they say, we're not going to insure those roads anymore. Or your power is cut because your grid network is going to say, we can't keep putting these power lines back up again, or whatever that may be. So there's all these other little drivers as well.
What was the answer to that question?
What question?
Do people ever ask the insurer?
No, they didn't.
No. That's been my impression too. I look at you can see it from the prices.
Yeah.
They're not, the prices on coastal still going up. Everyone's
it's
happy.
Reflecting.
It isn't reflecting.
Going to happen.
People
because it's so far in advance. Next year is 2020. I still haven't got my head around it. I remember the millennium. You know, I went to Masterton for the millennium New Year's Eve because, we were all worried about
Y2K.
Y2K and the collapse of society in the year 2000. I thought, I'll go to a place where the apocalypse has already happened. I don't care. Hold up in Masterton for the evening. Spent a lot of it in a pool. Water in darkness. It was a great experience.
That's where you want to be.
It's where you want to be.
For the end of the world.
Yeah. But you know, when you think 2040, 2060, it just seems...
It's only two decades away.
It's my 4-year-old daughter in 20 years, she's only going to be 24.
Mm.
You know, it's not very
These time frames are short.
The time frames are short. And I think for a lot of people, I think deep down, people just don't want to believe it's true, because if we believe it's true, it's really hard.
Well, I was thinking before when you said about the eco-anxiety, I was thinking for me it's more around, it's just so, our world is actually mostly, in New Zealand, just so beautiful, and
gorgeous.
We're so lucky here, and we're more or less just, if it wasn't for what we were hearing in terms of reports or statistics, it's like, if I could just ignore all of that.
And the fact that we sit on the Ring of Fire. I'm so positive. Here's the
thing. Even then, it's like, my life's been pretty good, actually.
Yeah,
and so if it was just a smaller little sphere of my understanding of the world, I could just be having a great old time.
Yeah.
But instead, it's like you're holding this enormous burden of an understanding of what's about to happen that we haven't seen much on the ground experience of.
Yeah, and how, you know.
So it's easy. So what I'm saying is that it's a really valid choice to just ignore it.
Yeah.
You hear it and go, well, actually, I'm kind of enjoying my life.
And also, valid, but also, but you know,
understandable.
What can an individual do often? You think, well, I'm not buying a plastic bag. Who cares? Am I putting something in a recycling bin? Well, I've long ago gave up on recycling. I haven't given up on recycling, but I'm less likely to believe the myth of recycling.
Well, you realise that is the crux of our show, what an individual can do.
So here's the thing. This is the conclusion I came to. Find the positive people, and with Alana through that. And there was a great, look for what the benefits of all of this change and this disruption is going to be. So if you're looking at, say, you know, carbon free cities and public transport and all of that, there was a wonderful line from a scientist that Alana Mitchell interviewed when she wrote a big article for one of the Canadian elections on what does 2050 look like in a carbon free world, because you know we all think, oh God, what does it look like with this apocalyptic event bearing down on us? But if we make these changes, and there was a scientist who said, particularly for urban areas, he said, we will measure the success of our work by the return of bird song. By which he went, not necessarily that birds will return to cities, but that cities will be silent because we've got rid of noisy combustion engines and various things, and we will once again hear the bird song.
That's a cool metric.
You know, because most people, if you live in an urban area, you've never really heard your city silent.
This episode is brought to you by Ecotricity, New Zealand's only power company that's 100% renewable and carbon zero certified. It's Ecotricity's mission to provide Kiwi homes and businesses with 100% pure renewable power. By choosing Ecotricity, you're supporting the development of new renewable energy and proving New Zealand's economy can grow without costing the earth. Find out more and sign up at ecotricity.co.nz.
Here's the thing, because I feel like we've been chatting for about half an hour. No, it's not that, but I feel like a lot of the thing, specific examples that we've been talking about so far are reasonably dark, and it's a dark vision of the
future.
Let's
bring it back to something positive.
But I think you are a positive and optimistic guy.
Yeah.
And I think that they're just tagging on to what you were saying about kind of building this world vision for what 2050 can look like in a carbon-free cities and planet. There's like a few documentaries that are coming out now which are sort of painting that frame for people and letting people know what it can look like. And there is a staggering amount of opportunity in lots of different ways. And when you're talking about what can the individual do, I'm a stupidly optimistic person about the ability and potential of the individual and what the individual can achieve. And I think, you know, you just need to open a history book or a Facebook at the moment to kind of see examples of how powerful one person can be and what can happen when you just start giving a shit and start communicating with other people who do. And a good example that I'd put forward at the moment, because I follow American politics pretty closely, is the Green New Deal.
How do you balance that off with your optimism for how humanity is progressing?
You know, it's a complicated story. But right now, so Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
who's amazing,
just this incredible an individual who came up, gave a shit, coalesced with other people around her who gave a shit, and became the youngest ever woman to get elected to Congress. She's now just got this incredible social cachet to the point where, you know, so much ink was written about who she was going to endorse to be the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. She's 31, I think, right now. And she was the one everyone was paying attention to. She's championed the Green New Deal, which is a fantastic example of a set of new bills and laws and legislation that would be America-wide, which not only pays attention to the changes they need to make for the environmental progress and restoration of the country, but bringing into that all of the social and economic components. And there's so much opportunity for those two things to be linked together, to have job programs that are linked to greenifying the economy, basically, and getting
sustainable technological jobs.
There's a hierarchical structure that's been built around the oil industry and petroleum and how it's produced and all of its ancillary products. And there is an opportunity now that we see that that's not a sustainable way to go forward for the next, well, whatever, few decades, basically from 5 years onwards, if you listen to most scientists. So if we do move to this new future, there is a whole other blueprint we can put, which is socially a lot more just for people to get involved with. And I think the thing that we've got over the animal kingdom is imagination. That's like the one defining feature of humans. We were the first ape to be able to go, but what if? And then paint this other picture and then gravitate towards it. And that is the thing that gives me a huge amount of optimism for the future. Because I think more people are getting on board with that picture.
I think, you know, and what we do is we find those people who are doing amazing things and we celebrate them and we talk about them and we say, hey, did you know this is happening or that's happening? And, you know, I do a lot of awards nights and this, that, and the other thing. And I often say to people, look, you know, or conferences, I say, individually, none of us might ever, we might not change the world, but we can change our world. And even if it's local, even if it's within your whānau, your community, your society, your workplace, your sports club, your church, whatever group it is that you belong to, you know, you can make huge changes within that and that then filter out because
kind of brings you back around to you are changing the world. Like because it might not be from your perspective that you have, but you're just bringing in so many other people that are all doing the same thing and all acting in the same way, but you don't know each other.
That's right. And actually, if you go back to that very first series of Off the Radar, which is where we started this conversation today, whilst it was about sustainability and
this
food,
was Radar's TV show.
It's a TV show, you know, what that program was actually about was people and community and people helping other people and people with positive attitudes and people just doing the things that they thought were better for everybody. And that's what it was actually a celebration of. And so I think, you know, bringing everything back to that kind of human context and allowing yourself to rid yourself of the naysayers and the negative people and to look for positive things and then to celebrate them, because otherwise, you know, you do get caught up in this, you know, world of negativity.
With that in mind, does anything specific come to you right now that you've seen recently that you're pretty pumped about?
That's a good question, Tim. There's lots of little things. I I host a lot of awards nights, just about every week. And what I
a lot of awards.
There's a lot of awards. Concrete industry, security, tech, you know. And there's awards for things that none of us will even know existed. You know, there's a big internet security awards next week that I've hosted for a few years. You know, they're getting awards for stuff that it's almost like that because they've done a thing, no one ever knows that that thing was ever done.
Because they've done it well.
Because they've done it really well. Yeah, yeah. And so our internet didn't get turned off. I'm just really inspired by how amazing people can be and little things, you know. And as I say, it's often things that and young people. I'm really into young people at the moment.
They are blowing it out of the ballpark at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So young people and just people who want to just forget about moaning and just get on with stuff. You know, I like good old, lovely old Greta, who I referred to the other night at a function as kind of, you know, our modern day Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
You know, who's being set on fire by the sort of the cardinals of capitalism because they don't want that message. But that belief that suddenly, you know, she got all those kids out onto the street because it is their future. And then those, can we swear?
Those podcast, baby. No rules here.
Those fucking people who just went, I bet they drove there in their combustion engine cars and they're using their iPhones and this, that, and the other thing. It was, of course they are, because they've never been given another option.
Yeah, you can only use the tools that exist in real life.
And so, you know.
Oh, I know. It drives me nuts too. It's like, because we all are in this current solution that we've all just got to use the tools and we're all doing our best to keep up with things as well. Like if we all walked to wherever we had to go, we wouldn't be here right now.
Well, no, I wouldn't make it to the march. No, I wouldn't. No, I drove.
Maybe this is the path where this chat has led to. What in terms of you being a public communicator, someone who's out there in the far reaches of New Zealand, how should we be approaching these sorts of conversations? And like, it seems like you're almost saying, put the blinkers on for the negative people. Let's just focus on getting the positive people who have got the good messaging and coalesce around them. Would that be?
Attitude? And there was that study I think that came out of the States or something around how you convince people of something, whether it's right or wrong for science. Yeah. And actually, part of it was just forget those people whose minds will never be changed and just focus on the low hanging fruit. You know, and as I say, and when you see things, you know, particularly I see these awards, and they happen, and then no one ever really speaks of them again, but there's some amazing stuff happening. And I think finding those stories and emphasising those stories and celebrating those stories of people who do whatever it is, whether it's in agriculture, you know, and I went to a launch the other day of a fertiliser, you know, people don't like fertilizer, but suddenly and the fertilizer companies know they don't like fertilizer, and they know that their social license is rapidly contracting around them, and they're looking to change what it is that they do to become around tech and innovation and science and monitoring. And so they've just come out with a new fertilizer that reduces, I think, phosphate runoff by 75%, kind of thing, you know, which is eventually that product will probably disappear as well. We're plagued by kind of relatively poor.
But it does show you that people getting pissed off actually does translate to change.
And actually, there's been a lot of, even in that field, they had a, they've got GPS on top dressing planes now. So they're
what's a top dressing plane?
Are you serious?
It flies over the country and pours fertilizer all over the land. And you used to just do it by guesswork.
Have you ever seen those planes
I don't know what they were called.
Quite a dangerous kind of thing to do as a pilot. And also, you would see it, and it was just like throwing handfuls of fertilizer at the world, and it would drift off everywhere. And now there's technology where it's computer controlled. You put it all into a GPS, so it won't put anything on waterways, houses, areas, land contours, all changes. But actually, they won an award for health and safety because it made the job of being a top dresser pilot much safer. It's all these kind of little benefits,
little win-win
if you want to be a top dressing pilot. Yeah. I don't imagine that we will be top dressing forever, but maybe we will, because, you know, it goes back to how we're going to grow food, I suppose.
There's a few options.
There's a lot of options, and I'm, you know, there's a lot of options. And I mean, really interesting was the vegetarian vegan debate, traveling the country talking to predominantly meat and dairy farmers. not many of them.
Not a lot of vegan dairy.
Some of their children do turn out to be vegetarians, though. That's always neat. Some of the children do. Like, you can grow like yourself. You've grown up in a particular environment and then you sort of twist it a bit.
That's exactly right. I always ask, you know, people who are really into almond milk, you know, say, where's your almond milk from? Because, you know, you don't want to look at the water footprint of almond milk. Having said that, you know, there's always lots of those. Of that. I still think that vegan-vegetarian conversation is such bullshit. That stigmatization.
You know, I'm vegan,
it's the stigmatization of it and the labeling of it. You know, and I say to these people, you know that every single vegan and every single vegetarian consumes the produce of farmers. And you see them go, oh, it just might not be what you farm, but there's a whole lot of other people providing soy and wheat and, you know, carrots and potatoes and lettuces and cauliflower. So I'm fascinated even with where, you know, at the moment I'm really, really into vertical farming, which is growing particularly your leafy greens and other things inside buildings.
I've seen some videos on there in Japan. And it looks super cool. The efficiencies that they can create in those controlled environments.
Amazing. So you're also looking at not only warehouse scale, but I met a young guy from Hong Kong at the field days, and he said, I said, why are you here? He was a part of a delegation. He said, looking at vertical farming. I said, what, you know, like shipping container size? Because you can buy now off the rack shipping containers that will grow all your vertical greens for restaurants and schools and whatnot. And he said, no, we can't afford the ground rent for a shipping container. We're looking at vending machines. And so you will go into the foyer of your apartment building and you will have a vending machine full of herbs and bok choy and leafy greens.
It's
and
growing
whatnot.
There.
They may begin the growing process in a separate facility,
sure.
But they will come around every morning, like filling a salad vending machine or whatnot in those high density areas, and just pop in some new tubes of produce. So suddenly, A, you're growing incredibly local. B, you're incredibly fresh, so your food waste is just down. And C, for places that are absolutely and rightly paranoid around provenance of food and where it's come from, you've got that tracked the whole way along the supply chain. You know where the water's come from through their filtration systems. It's put into this thing, the growing medium, and suddenly there it is. So, you know.
It does seem like a lot of solutions are coming
There's
through
so
the
many.
Change of the way we do distribution.
Distribution's
it's
massive.
It's huge. And low. It always comes, for me, it's always coming back to local.
Local. I was at I did a fintech presentation the other day of all these companies pitching apps and stuff to the financial and tech industries. And, you know, it was mortgage repayments and loans and this and that and the other thing. And there was this wonderful presentation from Robin Guyton from down at
Riverton.
You know Robin?
Oh my God,
I love him so much, you know. And their presentation was essentially a kind of a local app that people could come into and join for produce and whatnot, so that you would, if you were a little provider of something, you could link into the system and people could get it. So essentially, one of the examples she gave was, say there's someone doing got a little cool truck and they're running some fish up that people may have joined like a food bag of fish for the provinces, yep. or meat or dairy. There's a lot of people doing dairy at the moment, so either raw milk, organic milk, small local processes. And I think that I'm really looking forward to a move back to those little local processes now that there's a lot of unemployed stainless steel fabricators in the oil and gas industry in Taranaki. I'd love to see a move back to small cheese factories, small dairy factories, small abattoirs. You know, I heard of someone the other day who,
and the platforms are already there for
there,
it,
you know, just need some help there. Anyway, so this app, basically, you could say, hey, look, I've got a little milk truck and I'm doing this milk run. And someone goes, well, I've got fish and I've got meat and I've got produce that I can't deliver. So we'll know that the truck is going up to Lumsden or to Waikaya. And you can see on the app, the little delivery, it's going to be at 2:32. We'll pop down and we'll get our produce from these suppliers, you know, so fresh, could be, it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, wholesome, organic, local.
But trackable,
but
so
trackable.
People can actually
trackable.
See where their food's
But also for
from.
Them, it was around food sovereignty and food security, because when the earthquake hit in Christchurch, supermarkets and places in Invercargill ran out of food.
Mm.
You know, so they want that kind of thing.
So that kind of dispersed model, which can spread the risk.
Yeah. Actually, a big part of this is cutting out the middle person as much as possible, because the smaller scale isn't as profitable. That's why people max up, and to be able to shift it around a little bit and go directly from the farm to the gate.
That's happening at the moment. To me, the layperson, it feels like that movement.
There are QR codes on products in Asian supermarkets, and you scan the QR code and it will tell you, A, where the product has come from, show you the grower, and tell you what they were paid for it. Now, how does that disrupt?
That's awesome.
How does that disrupt all of those middle people? Because you remember there was a while ago, while we were doing off the radar, there was a spike in the price of a whole lot of stuff, grain and wheat and various things. It wasn't that there was a shortage, just that those people who were on selling those things whilst they're being transshipped, just clipping the ticket all the way along. So the farmers aren't getting the money. And they, you know, and I'm talking about not only the small farmers, you know, the little farmers, the subsistence farmers growing just enough to make, you know, they're getting paid the minimum, and someone's just clipping that ticket, and by the time it gets to wherever it's sold in the far off western country, the price is astronomical. So that eliminates that kind of thing. What makes you, who do you celebrate at the moment?
Well, I went to the permaculture hui earlier this year, and it was at the Guyton's.
Yes, it was.
And it was amazing. Those guys have got a little cottage that looks like it was built at the turn of the last century, but it's brand new, and it's made entirely out of refurbished materials that they found. And it's all solid wood, all cheap as chips. They live in the middle of a food forest, which is kind of like an orchard on steroids. It's got five layers of food productivity, just like a regular jungle would have, your top, your middle, and middle, and middle, and bottom. And they don't sort of garden it. They just bring it.
They just planted the right stuff.
I guess you have one of the big issues with the way we farm, like you're talking about before, Tim, is monocultures. And then if it's not stable, that's why you have to use the fertilizers and why you get the problems. But as soon as you introduce diversity back, which is a food forest is a classic case of really extreme diversity, you get stability. So one plant will provide a nitrogen fixer for another. And there's all this companion planting, and once the idea with it is once the system gets going, which theirs is, it's really established, you don't have to do anything. You just walk around through the forest picking food.
They also have a project down there where they saved a whole lot of heritage apple trees, amongst other things. I could talk for hours around the fuckapapa of apples and how important that project was for the future of food diversity. You know, I think that we shouldn't judge ourselves here on how we farm. We've got a lot of changes to make, but we shouldn't get caught up in the sense that we're the same as, say, the States. You know, the States, their agribusiness model is absolutely failed, and there's no such thing really. You know, those little individual farmers and chickens or pigs, you know, they're gone. And I think, you know, what they... $28 billion in subsidies or something that they've just paid because of the whole soy deal.
I could get this slightly wrong, but I think a third of all the money that farmers are getting in the States this year is from subsidies.
It's bonkers.
Can you imagine what that money would do for subsidising something else?
Their soil is dead. And Michael Pollan writes about, you know, if you're an alien and you came down, you would think that corn was the ruling species on this planet because of how much corn is growing. You know, but their model has failed. It's a fail. It's just their system has failed. Their system is sick. You know, when you got to bleach your chicken, you know, but let alone your workers' rights.
Good ideas are incredibly contagious, and why don't we let New Zealand be the positive contagion, the patient zero of some of these fantastic ideas? And as you were saying, around the country, some people are trying some really incredible, innovative new solutions to this.
And it takes a while for things to catch on, but they do. And the more that we celebrate them, and the more that we tell people about them, you know, how often have we seen a good idea where we went, oh man, I didn't know anything about that. I'm going to do that.
Well, look, that's the whole reason, Detre, for us being here.
Raider, what is the one thing you think is the most effective thing we could do? In terms of sustainability.
Celebrate success. Celebrate success and inform people of things that are different and things that work. Don't get caught up in the doom and the gloom of everything that is predicted to happen because you become paralyzed. Celebrate the things that can happen. Look through the change to what society could possibly be like. You know, and there was there's some great writers around this who said, you know, actually what we're trying to create is a society that's more equitable, more, it's easier, it's sustainable. There's a more sense of community. But there are so many challenges, you know. Even the other day, I read an article about the negativity. You know, the death of socialization through workplaces. People can't. I can't say to you, "Oh, I can come to your wedding in 6 months' time," because I don't know from week to week what my job time is, because an algorithm is deciding when work is needed for the optimization of the capital of human labor. You know, there's all of those things. Having said that, there's also some amazing things, and using things for a positive manner, and just as I say, just relentlessly celebrate positivity. Try to make better individual choices in your diet and your lifestyle. Do you the best that you can do.
Thank you very much for joining us, Radar.
I've made no sense at all.
No, I'm on board. What an uplifting way to end.
You have to be uplifted, you know? Just, you know, summer is coming and be conscious of who you spend time with and what you eat and what you choose to go and see and do, because really humans are amazing and we really do live in one of the best countries in the world. Be someone who changes your world and the world around you. Be that person that just celebrates other people, whether it's their food, their art, their tech, their food gardens. The Guyton's are amazing. Go to Riverton.
Go to Riverton.
Go to Riverton.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Ecotricity, New Zealand's only provider of 100% renewable and carbon zero certified electricity. Find out how to switch your home or business at ecotricity.co.nz.